from San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
We knew that when plutonium served as the explosive ingredient of an atomic bomb, that the products would be radioactive fission products. Of course, we were in a race with Hitler's scientists. In fact, we thought we were in a losing race. We felt it was a matter of life and death.
It's hard to say what Dr. Glenn Seaborg is best known for. With Dr. Edwin McMillan, he co-discovered plutonium, and with his co-workers, he went on to discover 9 more elements on the periodic table. He holds a Nobel Prize in chemistry, has chaired the Atomic Energy Commission, and has served as Chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley. Moira spoke with Dr. Seaborg in his offices at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory.
Dr. Seaborg, you worked on the Manhattan Project. What was your role in the Manhattan Project?
In some ways, my co-workers and I were the people who did the experiments that led to the origin of the Manhattan Project. We discovered plutonium here at the University of California at Berkeley in 1940-41, and this led to the creation of the plutonium part, which is essentially one half of the Manhattan Project. The other was to produce the enriched uranium-235, the fissionable isotope of uranium. We showed that plutonium, which could be produced from the other isotope, the abundant isotope of uranium, uranium-238, we showed that that plutonium, which has the mass number 239, that is plutonium-239, is fissionable with slow neutrons, and that showed that it could be a source of nuclear energy.
So you did pre-work to the Manhattan Project.
Yes, we worked before the Manhattan Project, before there was any governmental support for our work. In fact, the discovery of plutonium was one of my faculty research projects, and a graduate student of mine worked on the discovery of plutonium and used this for his PhD thesis. It's a remarkable PhD thesis.
I would say. Well, you and Dr. Edwin McMillan received your Nobel Prize for creating plutonium. Quickly, I just want to ask you, is it a liquid or a gas or a solid? What does it look like?
Well, Ed McMillan and I should have mentioned the graduate student's name too, Arthur C. Wall. Ed McMillan and I received the Nobel Prize for the chemistry of the transuranium elements.
Ah.
This is for determining the place in the periodic table of the elements beyond uranium, the elements which have an atomic number greater than 92. To answer your question, plutonium is a metal, rather active, chemically active metal, much like uranium in its chemical properties, and it fits into the periodic table as part of a transition series of elements in which there are 14 places where the electrons go into inner parts of the atom. These are called F electrons. And therefore, this actinide series, as we call it, is placed not in the body of the periodic table, but at the bottom of the periodic table, just as the long-known rare earth elements, which are known as the lanthanide elements, are placed in a row of 14 elements at the bottom below the main body of the periodic table.
Well, our listeners can't see this great periodic table of elements that I have to, sitting next to us here, but I have to say when I walked in, I just about froze, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's going to be a test, and I still don't remember them. when I was studying, there was a lot fewer of them. So I'm getting over the fact this periodic table is sitting right here looking at us. Is plutonium by itself radioactive?
Yes, plutonium is radioactive. All of the, well, uranium is radioactive too, but it has such a half-life, that's the time it takes for half of it to decay by radioactive emissions. It has such a long half-life of billions of years that it still exists on Earth. All of the elements beyond uranium, uranium has the atomic number 92, that it means it has 92 protons in its nucleus. All of the elements beyond uranium, which we call the transuranium elements, and which have atomic numbers, therefore, of 93 and higher, are radioactive and have long since disappeared from the face of the Earth. Oh, there are trace quantities of plutonium produced by the action of neutrons in uranium ores, but all of the primordial plutonium has disappeared because of its half-life. The famous plutonium-239, the fissionable form of plutonium, has a half-life of about 24,000 years. That means that it decays, changes into another element, at a rate where half of it undergoes that transformation in a period of 24,000 years. And then the remaining decays in the same way. Half of the remainder decays in the next 24,000 years and so forth. That's what's meant by half-life.
Ah, so it's not like in the second half the whole rest of it goes.
No, no.
Half again.
Half again and then half again and then half again. You might say that it never all disappears, but
you have that sense, don't you?
But of course, when you get down towards the end and a few atoms, finally they're all gone.
So naturally, there is some plutonium which exists on the Earth.
There is a little bit of plutonium, yes, about, you know, one part in a million
mm-hmm.
of uranium ores.
Mm-hmm.
That is there because the uranium absorbs neutrons, which are present on
uh-huh.
Earth, and transforms it into plutonium the same way we do here in the nuclear reactors when we manufacture plutonium. And, of course, plutonium has, in the intervening years since our discovery, been manufactured in huge quantity, hundreds of tons. And this has led to a problem as to what to do with it now that...
Now that we've made it.
Now that we've made it and the Cold War is over, and it doesn't look like we need it for nuclear weapons. But it could, of course, be used perhaps as a nuclear fuel in nuclear power reactors to generate electricity.
This manufactured plutonium, does that have a half-life of 24,000 years?
Yeah, the plutonium we manufacture... I say we, the United States, Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, and Great Britain, France, and so forth, is the plutonium-239, which has a half-life of 24,000 years. That, of course, gives everybody plenty of time to to use it. It doesn't disappear at any noticeable rate.
Right. Well, certainly when you were originally working with the plutonium, you knew of its radioactive properties. And as it's leading into the Manhattan Project, one would certainly suspect that the nuclear explosion would have some level of radioactivity to it. How dangerous was radioactivity thought to be at the time?
Well, the plutonium itself is poisonous if it's ingested. Particularly if it's breathed in. It's not so poisonous if it's eaten and ingested, because then it sort of goes through you. But if you breathe it in, it's poisonous. And also if you accidentally get it into your bloodstream, We were careful. We took pains. Of course, in the process of producing the plutonium, there were a number of very radioactive so-called fission products, and we had to guard ourselves against those. So we worked with intervening shields of lead and so forth to absorb the radiation and to keep our exposure to a minimum.
Mm-hmm. Did people have, and you may not be able to answer this question, did people have, in the sense that they knew they could create, well, they were trying to and eventually did create a nuclear explosion, did they have a sense that they would be generating more radioactivity and what would happen to it? Was that?
Oh, yes. We knew that when plutonium served as the explosive ingredient of an atomic bomb, that the products would be radioactive fission products. That was well known. Of course, we were in a race, we thought, with Hitler's scientists. In fact, we thought we were in a losing race because the scientists in Germany, Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann, had discovered in 1938, the December 1938, the famous nuclear fission reaction. And we felt that, therefore, the German scientists were ahead of us, and we were in a catch-up game, trying to see if we could catch up with them to produce an atomic bomb before they could produce an atomic bomb. We felt it was a matter of life and death.
So that the effects of radioactivity were known at the time.
Oh, yes. The effect of radioactivity was known. We were conscious of it, and we took precautions as we were doing our work.
But the concept that the world was at war and that...
The world was at war at that time. It looked like it would be possible to produce an atomic bomb. The atomic bomb would have a decisive effect in determining who would be the winner of the war. We thought the Germans were ahead of us in producing the atomic bomb, and we ran scared.
Yeah.
I moved to Chicago, where the plutonium project was centralized, where the reaction, the chain reaction for producing plutonium was demonstrated by Enrico Fermi and his co-workers in the famous experiment performed on December 2nd, 1942. At Chicago, I was in charge of the other part of the project, which was to devise the chemical processes for the extraction of the plutonium after the operation of the chain reaction, which would produce it, along with these huge amounts of radioactive fission products. So I was in charge of the group that worked out, that conceived and developed the chemical extraction process, which was used at the production plant in Hanford, Washington, after it was tried out in a pilot plant at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And we succeeded in producing conceiving, developing, and producing a chemical extraction process, which was put into operation through the construction of a huge chemical extraction plant at Hanford, where the whole process operated behind many feet of concrete shielding, 6 or 8 feet of concrete shielding, in order to shield the operators from the intense radioactivity that was produced in the fission products that were produced at the same time as the plutonium was produced in these chain reactors, or piles, as we call them. Enrico Fermi coined the word pile. It was just a pile of uranium and graphite, and he called it a pile.
And it stuck.
And the name stuck.
How many people worked on this whole Manhattan Project?
There were thousands of people on the Manhattan Project. In the my part, which had to do, as I have said, with the development of the chemical process for the extraction of plutonium and separation from the fission products and uranium, there were hundreds of people. It was a tremendous rate of development. We made our first bombardment of plutonium in December, of uranium, to produce the first isotope of plutonium that we identified in December of 1940. In 1941, in the spring, we discovered the main isotope, plutonium-239, and showed that it was fissionable. We moved to Chicago, to the so-called metallurgical laboratory, in the spring of 1942, found the chemical process for the extraction of plutonium in December of 1942, had it operating in a pilot plant at Oak Ridge in the fall of 1943, and had it operating in the huge production plant at Hanford, Washington, in December of 1944.
So it was 3 short years.
Yeah, those was a fantastic rate of progress. It has, of course, never been equaled since.
What was the spirit of that team?
The spirit was of the whole team was very good, because they felt that they were in a life and death race, and we didn't want to lose. We worked 6 days a week, and usually held meetings 4 or 5 evenings a week, and at one stage even on Sunday mornings. So we were going at a good pace.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Glenn Seaborg, Nobel laureate, former head of the Atomic Energy Commission, associate director of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and chairman of the Lawrence Hall of Science at the University of California, Berkeley. I was reading about Dr. McMillan, and I saw where he introduced himself to his future wife by dropping a dead rattlesnake in her lap. I'm saying, you scientists really have a way with women.
he caught her attention.
He got her attention. Uh-huh. And I was reading about the Rad Lab. This is all in the context of the Rad Lab gang, as you were called, and you were all connected in so many ways. Dr. McMillan and Dr. Lawrence married sisters. Dr. Lawrence's brother, Dr. John Lawrence, was also a member of the group. And I understand there was an incredible spirit of cooperation.
Well, also my wife, the girl I married, Helen Griggs, was Lawrence's secretary.
Oh, you're
yes. So there was a connection there, too.
There was so much that came out of that group. What was that like? That's so unusual to see so much cooperation and interconnectedness.
We were living in an interesting time. We didn't know that it was unusual. Lawrence had invented the cyclotron, had built several versions of it of increasing size, and we used it to conduct experiments. Before I was involved with the discovery of plutonium, I was involved with a young physicist named Jack Livengood in the production through the cyclotron, and hence the discovery of a number of radioactive isotopes, which are now the workhorses of nuclear medicine. Iodine-131 and cobalt-60. With another young physicist, Emilius Gray, technetium-99M. And these isotopes now are used in millions of applications for the diagnosis and treatment of disease in the United States per year in the United States, and equally large numbers throughout the world. My own mother had her life saved and prolonged many years through the use of iodine-131. She had the thyroid condition, hyperthyroid
yes.
condition. She would have died within a few months. It was diagnosed and treated with iodine-131, and it prolonged her life for many years. And, of course, I and my wife and daughter and have all been diagnosed with technetium-99M. The diagnosis turned out favorable, so I just use that to illustrate what a role these radioactive isotopes that we discovered in the 1930s here at Berkeley are playing in the world today. But as I say, we just thought it was our research program. It was interesting. We didn't foresee any of these life-saving applications of these radioactive isotopes. We were just doing it to increase knowledge.
Pure science.
Pure science, absolutely. Basic research for the purposes of increasing knowledge. And it turned out that it had this tremendous payoff for the benefit of mankind.
Now, the Rad Lab gang during the 30s, was that the period that you were privately funded, or had the federal government funding started to
during the 1930s, we were privately funded and through the university. The governmental funding didn't come until after the Manhattan Project, the war years. And then, of course, our whole life was changed. It had demonstrated what a role science could play, you know, producing the atomic bomb that led to an end of World War II. And from then on, we had a huge amount of funding from the federal government, which has, of course, continued until this day.
Now, you chaired the Atomic Energy Commission from 1961 to 1971, and this is a period known for significant development and testing of nuclear weapons. And yet the Test Ban Treaty with the Soviet Union and Britain was one of the crowning achievements of President Kennedy's short term in office. Were we as a nation confused as to which way to go on nuclear weapons? Are we
confused now, you mean?
No, were we then?
Well, I would say the height of the nuclear testing was really in the 1950s, atmospheric testing, before I became chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. Then in 1958, there was a moratorium on nuclear testing, spearheaded by President Eisenhower, but also adhered to by the Soviet Union. And this lasted until 1961, when the Soviets broke the moratorium in the fall of 1961 with an atmospheric testing series. President Kennedy was highly motivated towards a test ban. He hoped to achieve a comprehensive test ban, that is a test ban that would outlaw all testing of nuclear weapons. However, when the Soviets renewed atmospheric testing, he was forced to the decision that the United States should do another round of atmospheric testing. So he renewed atmospheric testing in the spring of 1962 until the fall of 1962. That was the last time we tested in the atmosphere. He continually sought a test ban. The Cuban Missile Crisis led to a realization of the stark reality of what the consequences of a nuclear war would be, and this led both sides to the renewed efforts towards a comprehensive test ban. I visited the Soviet Union as the head of a delegation of U.S. scientists and engineers in May of 1963. I think this helped strike up a rapport. I met Brezhnev at that time. Khrushchev, of course, was the chairman. Then in August of 1963, Averell Harriman negotiated with his Soviet counterparts the limited test ban treaty. Mm-hmm. He tried for a comprehensive test ban treaty, but that foundered on the demands of the United States for on-site inspections and the refusal of the Soviet Union to allow the number that we wanted. And so they settled for a limited test ban treaty, which outlawed testing in the atmosphere but still allowed the testing underground. I was a member of Secretary of State Dean Rusk's delegation to the Soviet Union, to Moscow, where on August 5th, 1963, the limited test ban treaty was signed by the representatives of the three countries. Dean Rusk for the United States, Foreign Secretary Andrei Gromyko for the Soviet Union, and Foreign Secretary Lord Hume for the United Kingdom. But it was our disappointment and my disappointment that we had to settle for a limited test ban treaty at that time. If we could have obtained a comprehensive test ban treaty at that time, prohibiting testing, all types of testing, the world would be much better off today.
Limiting the spread of nuclear weapons has largely been done by trade restraints on materials and equipment and test ban treaties and treaties between countries that have it. And yet I understand that during the Gulf War, Iraq had produced enough highly enriched uranium to produce two nuclear bombs. How is that possible?
The controls through the International Atomic Energy Agency were not adequate to prevent this. I believe they were the signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits the development of nuclear weapons by the signatories. But the so-called safeguards, the inspection system, was inadequate. We need to strengthen that in the International Atomic Energy Agency, and as a result of the Iraq situation, I believe this is being done, and it's also, the whole situation is again being tested in North Korea, where North Korea has been giving signs that they want to go ahead and produce nuclear weapons, and they have in fact announced that they want to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is a sort of a crisis situation which is being dealt with as best as can by the International Atomic Energy Agency with the backing of the United States. I think the answer is to create a much stronger International Atomic Energy Agency that has the authority to go into countries who have in mind developing an atomic bomb and make inspections and reveal their intentions, and which should lead to means of preventing their carrying through their plans for making producing nuclear weapons.
Moira is speaking with Dr. Glenn Seaborg. Dr. Seaborg has authored over 500 scientific articles and was awarded over 50 honorary doctorates. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology with Dr. Moira Gunn. If you have any thoughts or comments about this or any other Tech Nation program, please send them to Tech Nation, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. That's Tech Nation, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. In 1983, Dr. Seaborg served on the National Commission on Excellence in Education and co-authored the much-publicized report, A Nation at Risk. He's currently a university professor of chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley.
Now, I understand that a lot of these countries that are able to go forward and produce the elements to make nuclear weapons, a lot of that came in with the technology for nuclear power plants.
Yes, nuclear power plants produce plutonium as a byproduct. And that plutonium, by the way, serves as a nuclear fuel as well as the original enriched U-235. In fact, about 40% of all the energy, electric energy produced in nuclear power plants today comes from the plutonium. That plutonium, if it would be chemically extracted, could serve as the explosive ingredients for crude atomic bombs. It's not in the best form. This is a source of worry that as the countries produce electric energy through nuclear power plants, they can divert it, some of the plutonium that is produced mm-hmm. there, to nuclear weapons. However, this has not been the approach used by any country up till now. It's always because it's a very inefficient approach. If a country wants to produce a nuclear weapons, this is a very inefficient way to do it. It's much more efficient to go directly, like Iraq has done, and like perhaps North Korea has been in the process of doing, to produce the fissionable material, U-235, for example, directly for the purpose of producing an atomic bomb.
So that the argument that I've heard that says the only reason they have any of that capability is because they've got these nuclear power plants, that's not true.
Well, I'm just saying that no nation has used that route to go to an atomic bomb.
They could, but they haven't.
But they could. It's a very inefficient method if their aim is to produce an atomic bomb. They use the nuclear power to produce electricity, like so many nations in the world are doing. We produce about 20% of our electricity in the United States from nuclear power plants. Worldwide, the figure is similar. I do not believe that it is at all feasible to stop the development of nuclear power because of the great need for electrical energy throughout the world. It is much better to have a strong International Atomic Energy Agency to police all forms of the production of fissionable material through the application of what we call safeguards. That is a system for inspecting and ensuring that fissionable material is not diverted from peaceful to nuclear weapons uses. That is the answer. To try to stop the development of nuclear power, I think, is counterproductive and not likely to lead to success.
I wanted to ask you just sort of a separate question here. Is I think people often thought that the Atomic Energy Commission were involved in nuclear weapons and they were looking at nuclear power plants to see how to produce electricity. It did much more than that, didn't it?
Oh, the Atomic Energy Commission, yes. They were involved in the development of nuclear power. They, of course, had the responsibility for producing the nuclear weapons for the Department of Defense, but they also supported a broad program of research in the physical and the biological sciences, a program for the support of education, a program for the production of radioactive isotopes, these life-saving substances for use in medicine. Mm-hmm. And they have very useful applications in industry and agriculture and so forth. The Atomic Energy Commission had a very effective program of international cooperation. When I was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission in the 1960s, I visited 60 different countries, forging agreements for cooperation that included the augmentation of the use of science for the benefits of the people in developing countries. So the Atomic Energy Commission had a very broad program.
I understand that you have been interested in a relatively new technique for generating nuclear fusion, which does not use radioactive fuel. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the technique for the production of electricity through what we call the fusion reaction has been focusing on a reaction that uses deuterium, a heavy form of hydrogen, and tritium, a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, which when they fuse give you helium plus neutrons. And then these neutrons unfortunately have the capability of making the surrounding materials of construction and so forth very radioactive. It also requires raising the temperature to very high levels in complicated apparatus known as tokamaks, magnetic confinement devices, which is technically very difficult to do. And work has been, in order to get a self-sustaining reaction, and work has been going on in this field for 30 or 40 years, and it looks like it might be another 30 or 40 years before it can be successfully accomplished. And when it is, it'll only be to produce neutrons, not to produce electricity. These neutrons, the energy of these neutrons then has to somehow be formed, transformed into electricity. There is another approach called aneutronic fusion. Aneutronic, you know, just no neutrons. You know, like typical, atypical.
Atypical, yeah.
Aneutronic, no neutrons. And this uses deuterium and helium-3, helium of mass number 3, neither of which is radioactive, and it produces helium-4 and protons, neither of which is neutrons. And it has the advantage that both of these are charged, and you can get a direct conversion to electricity, which makes it much more efficient. The problem is how to get these to react, and the idea that has been promulgated by Bogdan Maglik of the Advanced Physics Corporation, now in Irvine, California, is to have colliding beams produce devices where the deuterium and the helium-3 can collide, and this means you can raise them to enough energy so they do fuse and form the helium-4 and the protons. And these can be rather small, almost tabletop size, as opposed to the tokamak, which is, you know, the almost the size of a, I don't know what to compare it with, a huge, huge device, very, very large.
I mean, we're talking the size of a room or the size of a desk?
Size of a big building.
Oh, a big building.
Yeah.
One tokamak.
Yeah, one tokamak. It's a huge device. And these little aneutronic fusion devices can be quite small, you know, desktop sizes. And so the problem is to do the final research work that will demonstrate the feasibility of this, and it's been carried to through four stages, and there's really one more stage of research that's required to demonstrate that this is feasible. And that's what the Advanced Physics Corporation, under the leadership of Bogdan Maglik, is trying to accomplish.
Has there been government funding through those four stages?
There has been very little government funding. Maglik has raised the money through other sources to carry through the four stages. There had been there's been some government funding, but not very much.
It actually doesn't sound that much different than the Rad Lab gang back in the 30s without any government funding.
Yeah, it might be analogous to the Rad Lab gang back in the 30s, yes.
Sometimes we seem to say, well, it can't be real if the government isn't funding it.
Yeah.
I guess we have a couple of examples where that's not the case. How promising do you find this technology?
I think this is sufficiently promising that some portion of the money, government money, whatever source of money, investigating fusion should go into this approach.
Now, let me just make sure I understand. The tokamak, the standard radioactive fuel-based technique, is to take the elements and heat them up to a very high temperature.
Yeah, that's a colloquial term, heat them up. You use magnetic fields and so forth, but
charging.
The idea is essentially to get them up to very high temperatures, yes, so they can fuse.
And they have used both radioactive fuel, and they produce radioactive.
It produces neutrons. The fuels are deuterium and radioactive tritium, and it produces neutrons, which are absorbed by materials to render them radioactive.
Now, this aneutronic fusion is using a collider. Now, we've done shows on the super collider. And
yeah, it's a little bit like the super collider, except it's a much lower energy.
Uh-huh.
And the deuterium collides with the helium-3 form helium-4 and protons.
So the idea
no
is that when two...
Well, there are some side reactions that lead to a low level of neutrons, but it's, you know, estimated to be at the level of 1% or something like that. So it means that the problem of the radioactivity of the surrounding materials and so forth is minimized.
It's significantly less than the tokamak. Okay,
so
but what we're talking about is basically forcing elements into each other, and in that collision.
Yes, the device is something that accelerates the deuterium and the helium-3 in opposing directions so that they collide with each other, and that gives them enough energy to fuse and produce the products helium-4 and hydrogen-1.
So that it's looking at, we're saying we don't start with radioactive fuel. We produce some radioactive byproducts or offshoot, but anyway, it's at about 1% of the alternative energy here. And there is not the engineering problem, if you will, of charging up.
The engineering problem is minuscule compared to that of building a tokamak.
Well, after all these years of research with plutonium and tritium and other radioactive materials and tokamak, did you find that this collider approach was a little hard to fathom?
No. I haven't, of course, done research with the tokamak and so forth. No, I don't. I think the collider approach is easy to understand. It's just colliding the reactants in the head-on collisions where they can react with each other.
Is there a general feeling of acceptance in the scientific community at this point?
I would say that with respect to the feeling of the scientific community, there are three camps.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are involved with the tokamak, who understandably resent the competition and do not give this colliding beam approach a high estimate for success. Then there are those like Bogdan Maglik and a number of other people in a number of laboratories around the world that I won't try to identify, who have a conviction that this approach has promise, and in any case, a certain fraction of the funds going into fusion research should try this approach. And then there's the third category of the scientific community at large that just hasn't been paying much attention to this and doesn't have any particular opinion about it.
You know, we have science on the one hand, whether we're talking tokamak or we're talking a neutronic approach or whatever, which is very complicated to understand and comprehend. And we now have a huge body of public opinion, which over the years says, wait a minute, radioactivity is wrong, or even nuclear fusion is wrong. And I was reading in the paper just this morning, there was a picture of a young man being carried away from Lawrence Livermore Lab. How do all these things come together? How do we proceed forward in science and try to be unafraid and yet balance
where public opinion is? Well, I think we have to increase the level of scientific literacy of our population. I've been saying this for years.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Glenn Seaborg, Nobel laureate, former head of the Atomic Energy Commission, associate director of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and chairman of the Lawrence Hall of Science at the University of California, Berkeley. As a nation, what do you think our policy should be vis-a-vis the use of radioactive materials and radioactive waste?
Well, the use of radioactive materials, we're doing it all over the country in our hospitals, you know, radioactive isotopes in medicine and many useful uses in industry and agriculture. With respect to radioactive waste, we just have to decide on a geologic repository somehow. This can be safe. It could remain there for geologic times. We have the example of the Oklo Formation in Gabon, Africa, where a nuclear chain reaction took place in a huge uranium deposit billions of years ago when the uranium-235 concentration was high enough to do that, you see, before it decayed to its present levels. Now we have to enrich it in order to get a chain reaction. This reaction took place in place for a long period of time, millions of years, generated huge quantities of fission products. The scientists have gone there now, and they found that those fission products stayed right in place. They didn't migrate at all. And if that could happen with no precautions being taken, why can't we take a carefully prepared spot like the proposed site in Nevada, and put the radioactive material there for storage? It's a quite feasible thing to do. It's a problem that has a technical solution. It's the political solution that is holding it up.
In 1983, you were a member of the National Commission on Excellence in Education and co-authored with the other members of the commission the seminal report, A Nation at Risk, which everyone remembers, the imperative for educational reform. And it's been 10 years. And what's your sense? How are we doing?
During the 10 years for since the issuance of our report, which we handed to President Reagan on April 26, 1983, there has been an awful lot of activity. It has been followed by, you know, literally hundreds of other reports and so forth. We have made some changes in our educational system, but the changes are far less than what is required. You know, I could get into this in great detail. Far less than what is required. I can only say that if we hadn't made the report, issued the report, we'd probably be a lot worse off than we are today. We've sort of held our own as a result of the issuance of the report, but we haven't made much progress towards the improvements that are required in our pre-college educational system, particularly in mathematics and science.
Why is it so hard to teach math and science?
I don't think it is so hard. We have a system where people who are trained in school in mathematics and science aren't eligible to teach. They have to go on and take a number of education methods courses which drive them away, and reward that they get for that after they get their degree in mathematics and science and go on and take all these other courses is to go out into the schools and get a lower paying job than they would otherwise get by going into industry. So that is the problem. We need to change our system, and this is throughout the whole United States, so that people who major in science, say chemistry or physics, can go out and teach after the inclusion of a few education courses during their 4 years, so they get their degree in 4 years and then can go out and teach. That we need to make that change. That's easier said than done. It's almost impossible to do. Then you have teachers in the classroom, at least in theory, who understand and like mathematics and science and instill this into their students and inspire them to go on, and then you have a self-perpetuating situation. As it is now, we have teachers who are not trained in these subjects, don't like them, turn off their students. In the lower grades, these kids are all gung-ho and ready to go, but by the time they get into high school, they've been turned off, and they figure that science teaching is the last field that they'd want to get into.
You know, I've been fascinated. I'm looking at video games. I have two young boys, and they love video games. And
sure.
I didn't know whether I was aghast or pleased or ecstatic, and I ended up doing some research about it. And I found that there has been a number of studies made, and that the use of video games has been shown to improve two learning abilities,
yeah,
visual spatial skills and visual orientation skills, which are the two biggest predictors for success in,
yeah,
science and engineering. Do you think that the computers are going to help us?
Yes, but it isn't enough. I mean, it'll help, but it isn't enough. Another place where we are falling down is in the amount of money we devote to pre-college education. We need to infuse massive amounts of money into the system for equipment, raise teachers' salaries, lower classroom sizes, reward teachers who have majored in science toward going into the teaching profession, and so forth. And we're doing just the opposite. We're cutting down on the money in the pre-college school system, and cutting out classes and so forth. There we're going in the opposite direction. We need to convince the American people that we have to infuse massive amounts of money into the pre-college educational system. I don't predict that we'll succeed. I'm just saying that's what we need to do.
But we won't if we don't.
and if we don't, we're going to be in worse trouble than we are now.
So in a real sense, it's in investing in the infrastructure.
It's investing in the infrastructure where we are no longer living in a world where we need to put our money, our treasure, into defense. We need to put it into the educational system and the technical infrastructure of our country.
You have a number of things in common with Dr. Linus Pauling, whom we've spoken with. Besides the fact both of you have Nobel Prizes and some obvious things like that, you both taught freshman chemistry for many years. And freshman chemistry is an entry-level course that, you know, we weed out the incoming freshmen as well as motivate them on, spur them on. But those courses are often left to young faculty or even graduate students. And when you were asked about why you continued to teach it, you replied, well, the students seem to enjoy being with me for 3 hours a week.
Yeah.
But what about you? What did you get out of teaching freshman chemistry?
Well, I enjoyed it. I just liked to be with the students, and I thought it was playing an important role there.
You know, when I have to explain something that is the sort of basic in my what I'm doing in my kind of research or areas I'm working, I really find that other things on a higher level in my own work come up and fit
together. Definitely. Teaching makes you straighten out your own concepts. I must tell you that after I'd spent 10 and a half years in Washington as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, and then I was scheduled to meet with my first freshman class, I was scared. I studied night and day, you know, and I read the book. I worked all the problems backwards and forwards. You know, I didn't want to be caught in a classroom saying, you know, turn to page 530 in problem 3. Would you tell me how to work it? And I turned there and I wouldn't know how to do it. So I worked every problem and so forth. And as you say, I had to straighten out my concepts and I got by.
Yeah. That's like your toughest clients were.
Yeah, yeah.
18-year-old.
Oh yeah, no, they were. That was a tough assignment in my life to get back into the classroom, and I prepared myself so that I didn't have any question that I couldn't answer, but it meant straightening out my thinking and on basic concepts. That is correct.
Well, you're a young guy. You're only, 81, 82?
81.
81. What are you going to do next?
I'm working on 5 books. I just finished one.
Mm-hmm.
Two. The Atomic Energy Commission under Nixon.
Ah.
It's published.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That was my third president. Another one is my collected papers that is coming out this fall. Finishing touches of a book on my days as chancellor, Berkeley chancellor. You heard me talking to somebody about biographical information for use in my book, The Plutonium Story. That's going to be a book that uses my diaries, my wartime diaries, to describe the whole development, the discovery and the development of the separation processes and so forth for plutonium. And then I'm doing a book on the overall accomplishments during my 10 and a half years in Washington. That is my work with the three presidents, Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon.
So I don't see any retirement in the
No, I don't have any
time for that.
I don't have any plans.
Moira's guest has been Dr. Glenn Seaborg, Nobel laureate and chairman of the Lawrence Hall of Science at the University of California, Berkeley. During his public service career, Dr. Seaborg has served under 10 U.S. presidents. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans in Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional facilities at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.